This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. This week, we continue our series of interviews with Indiana authors nominated for the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards. Today, we talk to the authors in the genre category. We'll begin with Maurice Broaddus, who wrote Pimp My Airship. Maurice Broaddus, welcome to All In.
Oh, glad to be here.
So can you tell us about Pimp My Airship? What's it about?
Pimp My Airship is a steampunk novel. And steampunk is one of those funny little subgenres that sort of like science fiction and fantasy all mixed together. But in this world, America lost the Revolutionary War, and it remains a colony of England. And so, with that as its history, you know, Pimp My Airship is a story taking place in modern day Indianapolis, with a couple main characters. One is named Sleepy. He's an open mic poet, and there's a professional social provocateur, as he likes to call himself, 120 degrees of knowledge a la, who's trying to recruit Sleepy to join the cause. And then they eventually encounter another lady, whose name is Deaconess Blues. And the three of them basically form a cohort of what does it look like to leverage your gifts to, you know, create social change in the order?
What made you want to write this book about these specific themes right now?
Well, what I do with the bulk of my writing is I tend to, you know, look at the world around me, see what's going on, critique it. But I don't want to just critique it and deconstruct anything. I want to say, hey, this is where we are. These are the systems that we're living under. In the book, we talk a lot of the oppressive systems we're talking about is like redlining and over policing and criminalizing the poor. So as these themes are just weighing on me as I look at the world around me. But I also want to chart a way forward. I don't want to just sit there and wallow in the fact in the state of this reality. It's like, no, how do we move forward? And that's what I wanted to focus the story on is, you know, you have these different people, one a scientist, one a social activist, and one who's an artist. And what does it look like for them to come together, maintain their agency, and, you know, try to create change in the world around them? Part of that actually stems from my own internal struggle, which is, you know, I was looking at the world around me and I'm like, well, I'm just a writer. What can I do? And with that question in mind, you know, that's how I approached the stories with that big question. I was trying to answer, if nothing else, for myself. And then hopefully people enjoy the ride.
Do you feel like you answered it or at least explored it enough?
I do in a lot of ways. Sleepy becomes this fascinating character. Going from, you know, he just focused on, you know what, I have my daily grind, that's all there is, and going to poetry spots, that's my outlet. And then he goes from that sort of mindset to, wait, there are things going on in the world that I can change, or at least that I can see and speak to, and then much less join in with others to create change. And so that process, that roadmap that he creates for himself, sort of became the roadmap I began living my life by. Like, well, hey, you know what? This is actually some good advice he has in here. So let me go ahead and start being more intentional about my own life.
Isn't that interesting that you created this character out of whole cloth and you learned from them? I mean, it's not the first time something like that's happened, but I don't know how has that ever happened before. You're no stranger to writing. Have you ever done that? Anything like that before?
This is the first time it's been so explicit, I'll say. I'd actually come up as a horror writer originally. Hmm. And so a lot of my stories then, as I look back, was a different sort of catharsis. It was like I would look around the world around me and I would just sort of be angry. And so that's where a lot of those horror short stories came from, was me writing out of that anger. And so there's been a shift I've noticed in my writing in the last, you know, 5 to 6 years, where I don't just stay in that place of pain and anger. I'm more about, what does it look like to move forward? What does it look like to stay in the state of dreaming of better days? And so so my writing originally was me sort of like wrestling with my own internal demons. And now it's me wrestling with this whole aspect of dreaming about a better future.
So when you're exploring that part, this sort of positive social change, I mean, you're in this sort of fantastical world of steampunk. How does it look different there versus the way it would look in the real world? Are the parallels obvious?
Yeah, pretty obvious. That's actually one of the things I love so much about writing in genre, especially science fiction and fantasy, is, you know, I can create these sort of allegories and you know, different worlds and things like that. But they are very thin veneers to the actual world around me. So, but it does allow the reader a bit of a distance, a little bit of a remove, so they can be, I don't know, not feel like I'm throwing all these things like right in their face. There's a little bit of room where they can just go, well, I can just enjoy this for what it is. Well, you can, but you know, you don't have to scratch too hard before you go, oh, wait, I see what he's doing here.
So are you saying then that writing in genre sort of paints the lines on the road, whereas opposed to the kind of less framework that you get in just a broader category like fiction, that's almost too much freedom?
Yeah, because I don't know. There's just something about that distance that I guess is part of the tools of the genre itself, where, you know, because I have this tool of creating this distance, this thin veneer between the real world and this fantasy that I'm creating, I get to use that to my advantage. And I guess that stems from, you know, my love as starting as a kid of things like Star Trek. Star Trek was never a subtle series, you know, on its best day. It was never subtle in sort of the things it was trying to address. But you get caught up in the trappings of the genre, the spaceships and the aliens and the different worlds. But in the final analysis, it's examining the real world issues of what we're experiencing. And that is the my favorite way of just coming at story and looking at the world around me.
What was it like hearing that you got nominated for this award, the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indian Authors Award for Genre?
You know, even just hearing it again, it's just like, wow, it's real. Well, I've been writing for 20 years now. And so when I got news of that being shortlisted and everything, it's just like, I don't know. It's not like I look for outside things for validation, because I like to say that I write for me, and just completing a short story is all or a novel. That's all the validation I need. However,
it is nice when it happens, right?
It is sort of nice when it happens, and the fact that you know, my home state recognizes it means a lot. It does mean a lot, because I do love this city. I love this state, and I try to live my life in service to my community. So to have that recognized in this way, no, it did mean a lot.
Yeah, I've heard that said about awards like this and other awards for art, because art is just what it is. Sure, there's good art and there's bad art and there's art worth recognition and there's art that kind of can just live by itself for a little while and maybe it'll be appreciated later. But but it is nice when your peers can come together and review the work. And do you feel like, I mean, I guess if you're on the short list, you were understood. Do you feel like you've been understood by your readers? Have you heard from any of them?
Oh yeah, I've definitely heard from them. Yeah, it's been that's been its own validation, because you know, you spend the, you know, the months, the years writing this thing, and all you can control is putting the words on the page the way you always dreamt them. But once they go out, you're just sort of in the spot of, well, it's out of my control. Whatever happens with the reader, however they interpret it, however it lands with them, is kind of between the work and them. But to hear people go, hey, you know what, this book, I mean, yes, it has some pretty heavy themes to it, but daggone, I've never thought of a fun romp while exploring oppression. I mean, these are like the kind of sentences I'd get in like emails and things. That's like, that book was just so fun, and these characters were great, and it was just so funny, was all the things I was aiming for. I was trying to build, you know, like, yes, I want to look at these heavy ideas, but, you know, humor is one of the things I wanted to use to examine them, pick them apart with. And the fact that that came through, because that's always a tricky proposition. So for it to land as well as it did, it was just a huge sigh of relief for me.
What does a steampunk Indianapolis look like?
It looks like, honestly, it looks like an excuse for me to just traipse around Indianapolis and just sort of reimagine everything, to be honest with you. It was an excuse for me to, well, for example, go dig up like the original layout of the city, the turn of the century layout, and then study the turn of the century architecture. And then that became the visual backdrop for the city. I've spent a lot of time digging through the history of different corners of the city. You know, wherever the story would take place, I would go investigate the history of that area of town to say, how did we get here? What does that look like? And so all that backdrop of in fact, I wanted to key in especially on that turn of the century, 19th century Indianapolis. That was where I tried to tried to stay right within that zone, so that was the look. And then throw in things like, you know, robots and you know, airships and things like that, turning the Indianapolis Motor Speedway into an aerodrome, that sort of thing.
Oh yeah.
I stick with the alternate history, but then, you know, I can't get too far away from, well, who doesn't love a good giant robot just thrown in, you know?
Absolutely. 100%. So what are your future plans? What are you working on next?
Well, I'm working on a second middle grade novel. I had a middle grade novel come out last year called The Usual Suspects. I'm doing a second one, which I will be turning in, hopefully, in the next couple of weeks. It'll be called Unfadable, and it comes out next year. And then I have a science fiction trilogy called All the Stars that I'm working on. So that's going to be my first intergalactic tale. But I'm still determined that Indianapolis is going to play a key role in this. So,
ooh, wonderful. Maurice Broaddus wrote Pimp My Airship, and it is up for a Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award for genre. Maurice, thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Up next, a romance set in Indianapolis and a horrific graphic novel. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking with Indiana authors nominated for the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards in the genre category. And now, my conversation with romance novelist Sophie Caron. Sophie Caron, welcome to All In.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So what is Painted Over about?
So Painted Over is a story about two friends that were best friends all through growing up and into college, and then they had a falling out, and they meet each other again years later, and some sparks begin to fly. It's my novel about Indianapolis and a little bit about how much I love this city as well.
Oh, okay. So why set it here in Indianapolis?
Well, I'm born and raised in the Indianapolis area, and I'm kind of an Indianapolis evangelist. I've called myself a few times. I've moved away a couple of times and always tell everyone how great it is. And I was excited for the opportunity to set a book here.
Do you write a lot about Indianapolis, or is this the first thing you've really written about Indianapolis?
I've said a few stories here before, but this is the first. This is my first novel. And so I definitely wanted to start with a novel set here in my home city.
This is your first novel. What have you worked in before?
Mostly before, I've written short stories. Some of them were more speculative fiction. I had a short story published in the Kurt Vonnegut Library's annual journal. So it's been a little bit all over the place. But I've always wanted to publish a novel and plan on publishing several more.
You lived in New York for a couple of years, and then you came back to town. You've expressed your love of Indianapolis. I don't know. Did your perspective on Indianapolis change while you were there?
I think I got a greater appreciation for Indianapolis while I was away. I've moved away a couple times in my life, and I always end up missing it even more than I realize. But I've always known what a gem the city is. But definitely being away for a while makes you think about all of the things that you miss and that you just can't replicate somewhere else.
What did you miss?
I missed the sense of community, really, that we have in Indianapolis, the way that it's easy to get involved in organizations, and there's a lot to do here. I've never, ever been bored in Indianapolis.
Is there anything that you miss about living in the places that you've lived that are not Indianapolis that you wish we had a little more of here?
Well, when I moved up to New York, I learned that there are things called hills. I was used to the flatness of central Indiana. So it was enjoyable to be able to do a little more hiking and see waterfalls. A lovely place to go and visit. And I have lifelong friends there now that I can always go back and visit.
What attracts you to genre writing?
Genre writing to me has always been my main focus. And I remember when I was in college, I was so excited to take my very first creative writing class. And the first day, the instructor sat us down and on the board wrote down all the different types of genre fiction. And then he wrote literary fiction on the other side. And he said, "All right, we will be writing none of that. Only literary fiction is appropriate for this class." And it just broke my heart. Oh. Just because I love genre fiction. I love science fiction, romance. All of the different types of genre fiction kind of have their own conventions and rules that you get to work inside. But I think that also can give a lot of opportunity for creativity.
But it can also kind of, corral your creativity as well, which can be, which sounds like it could be stifling, but it can also be freeing in a way. How do you feel about that assessment?
I really enjoy working within certain parameters and seeing what I can do with them that's new and different, but still familiar. One of the things that I learned when publishing my book as technically a romance novel is that readers do have specific expectations. And so if you're going to change those, you have to do them really well. But also, I just enjoy being able to take something that is so established, like a form of genre fiction, and be able to work in that environment.
Now, admittedly, I am not a reader of romance. I wish I could say that I've read a single example, but I don't know that I have.
Well, it's never too late.
I guess it's not. And I might as well start with yours. How would you compare yours to some of the more well-known titles that are out there, or perhaps some of the more well-known authors?
Well, so I published my book through a publisher called Bella Books, and it is mainly a publisher of genre fiction, mystery, romance, mainly of women who fall in love with women. So my book is a little bit different in that way from the major publishers, although things are definitely changing. I don't know that I have an author that I would say I write in the same style as, but I definitely have enjoyed a lot of different writers who write in that romance fiction field.
That sounds really refreshing. Have you heard any criticism or any praise of your book?
Actually, surprisingly, I haven't. Other than every once in a while, someone doesn't like that I change something that goes with just general genre. But I've been very pleasantly surprised at the reception of my book.
Do you plan on staying in Indianapolis and just being a writer here? Are you done moving around?
I think so. I've learned from the times that I've moved out of Indianapolis that I love to visit other places and meet people and see all kinds of things. But this is really my home. So I would anticipate being a lifelong resident of Indianapolis. I'm happy to be so.
I'm not trying to dox you or anything, but what part of town do you live in?
So currently I live in the Fountain Square neighborhood. So I've lived in a few different neighborhoods throughout Indianapolis. So all over the place a little bit. Currently Fountain Square.
Where else have you lived in town, though? There's clearly a part of this town that has really imprinted on you. And Fountain Square is a great place to love and not want to leave.
So I've lived in Irvington. I've lived in South Broderville. I've lived in other areas near downtown. So I tend to circle somewhat near the downtown area.
What would you say the writing community is like in Indianapolis?
I think the writing community, it's constantly growing and changing. When I wrote the first draft of my book, I was going to writing retreats held by a now defunct organization called the Geeky Press. As far as I know, they're at least still on hiatus. The Indiana Writers Center is a very hospitable, wonderful place that I've taken some classes. I was actually thrilled when the genre fiction list came out and Maurice Broaddus was on that list because I've taken classes from him at the Indiana Writers Center. So it's been a very supportive community to be a part of.
Isn't he such a delight? I just talked to him.
He's wonderful and he is so creative. I took a world building class with him that it really gave me lots of new ideas.
Like what?
Like what it means to build, to use the name of the class, to build your world, to what really goes into creating that picture that people have in their mind of a place that, especially if you're writing science fiction or speculative fiction, that you can create in your imagination and then how to share that vision that's in your head with the readers.
So Indianapolis is the setting of the new novel, Painted Over, but a setting can also kind of be like a character in a way. In what way did you make Indianapolis a character?
Well, I was able to bring them to Mass Ave, down to the canal, to visit some of my favorite bars and restaurants around the city. So I feel like it also shows through the characters' interactions, the way that people here just have a particular warmth to them and that our community is really welcoming to folks that even if you haven't seen them in a while, just become family again once you see them.
So you use that kind of feeling that you get from people here in your hometown and you feel like you captured that?
I would like to say that I did.
You know, and I got to tell you, I feel that too. I feel that from people. And I don't know if it's an indie thing or a Midwestern thing. I don't know. How do you feel about that?
I haven't lived too many other places around the Midwest, but I would guess that it's probably more of a Midwestern feature. But Indianapolis is my favorite, of course.
We are among the best the Midwest has to offer. Sophie Caron wrote Painted Over, and it's up for a Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award for in the genre category. Sophie, congratulations on the book and the nomination, and thanks for coming on. Best of luck.
Oh, thank you so much.
And now, a graphic novel. Nate Powell has been writing them for years and in a lot of different ways, including adapting history to the comic format. Nate Powell, welcome to All In.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
So can you tell us about Come Again? What's it about?
Sure. It's you might even classify it as an existential fairy tale,
uh-huh.
But it's basically a horror and relationship story that takes place in the late 70s in a remote sort of half abandoned hippie village in the Ozark Mountains in Arkansas, my home state. And the plot is based around, you know, a small group of young people who moved there at the end of the peace movement. And now time has passed. They have grown into adults with children of their own. And so a lot of the themes involve, you know, what happens when you look around and your ideals don't match up with where your life is anymore? And what if that's okay? As well as themes about communities that are held up by openness and by people being a part of everybody else's business. But at the same time, the inherent human need for privacy, for secrecy, for intimacy, and the difference between all three of those things and how people are driven to carve out those spaces at any cost when those spaces are harder and harder to find. And then that's sort of where it jumps into a supernatural kind of Ray Bradbury, Ursula Le Guin story, where, you know, people really thrive off of this secrecy and thrive off of their own space. But there is, in fact, some sort of ancient unspoken demon or spirit that lives inside an abandoned diamond mine that the village rests atop, and it eats, it feeds off of the secrecy that people generate. And so this creature kind of invisibly manipulates some of the families in town in order to feed off of them. Then, you know, some very bizarre things happen. And it's kind of a tale of problem solving, reckoning with one's own mistakes and shortcomings, you know, redemption and sacrifice.
My head is spinning in the greatest of ways. I love it. Okay, so you're nominated for a Eugene and Marilyn Glick Award in the genre category, but do you consider this a piece of genre fiction? Did you think of it that way?
Well, I do think of it as fiction, as genre fiction, in terms of being horror related, or even I would even lean on fantasy, but it's closer to horror. There's part of me that thinks that that genre is intended to apply to the medium of comics, because it's a graphic novel. Just to state plainly, comics are not a genre. They're a format, they're a medium. But you can tell all kinds of stories within comics. I'm best known for doing nonfiction, memoir, and historical trilogies in the medium of comics. So it is by far my most genre-heavy book I've ever done. I don't know, it just feels good to lean into horror and mystery a little bit.
And to just share an example of that, civil rights leader and longtime U.S. Congressman John Lewis passed away recently on July the 17th. You worked with him on March, a graphic novel trilogy about the civil rights movement. What was that like? What did you learn from him?
Well, I mean, it was a transformative experience. You know, we spent the last almost 9 years together, the two of us and our co-writer, Andrew Iden. It was profoundly transformative in terms of reintroducing and revitalizing so much of the history of the movement in real time, while a series of harrowing social and political changes were happening in a strong shift rightward in our country. It was surreal and hyperreal on a personal level. Congressman Lewis, you know, we grew to be friends, as well as collaborators, and obviously he's a hero of mine. But I think being a parent and being involved with his account of his life and his involvement with the movement, but also his personal example of temperance, dedication, the right kind of stubbornness, the best kinds of commitment, these have all made me a better parent and have made me much better able to equip my children to be able to handle, you know, a very harrowing, unpromising future in their immediate landscape.
What other examples from your career are there of adapting history to graphic novel?
I started doing this with a couple of short stories in the late 2000s. I think my first experiment with it was after finishing my first graphic novel, Swallow Me Whole. I got interested in, at the time, a pretty unknown piece of American history, being the bombing of Black Wall Street in Greenwood in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Mm. And so I did a 9-page journalism comic on historical accounts I could find of the 1921 Tulsa massacre, and then moved from there into doing another piece that was an autobiographical memoir piece about a kid growing up in a white middle-class family outside of Houston, against the backdrop of a forgotten chapter in civil rights history. That was called The Silence of Our Friends. And my work on that book sort of served as a boot camp for everything I would need to apply and supercharge to be able to tackle the March trilogy to the best of my ability.
Is it easier in some ways to talk about heavy themes within the framework of a genre?
Oh, without a doubt. And I'd say whenever we're speaking about things in fiction that relate to us topically and, you know, in terms of what we're seeing outside of our window, all fiction speaks about, you know, components of our lives and of the human condition and of social and political issues, hopefully, in some way. But you always want to avoid having the sense that your fiction is serving the purpose of advancing your personal positions or perspectives unnecessarily. But the joy of fiction, especially when rooted through genre limitations, are that, I don't know, I'm the kind of person who believes in the opportunities provided by limitations, whether it's the limitations of format or the limitations of budget or the limitations of a medium. So I think some of the limitations of genre sort of set a storyteller free to find connections that may not have otherwise been evident.
And we have more next from graphic novelist Nate Powell on his book, Come Again. Today we're talking with Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award nominees in the genre category. I'm Matt Pelzer, back in less than 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today we're talking with Indiana authors nominated for the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards in the genre category. Right now, more from my conversation with graphic novelist Nate Powell, who wrote Come Again.
So within the pages of Come Again, you know, one of the strongest themes throughout the book is the horror of utter casualness in the face of an obvious community crisis. And without giving any spoilers in terms of what happens during the meat of the book, our protagonist is trying to fix this problem for which she is somewhat responsible. But over the course of several days, the problem shifts into a situation in which the other people in her village are losing the ability to even recognize or remember what the problem was. There are a lot of components like that which ring so true and so urgently right now in terms of where I see our community and our nation. But ultimately, these are plot elements which serve the story itself. And so that's the kind of thing that you don't necessarily plan for, but you sort of remain open to move in the directions that a story will lead you. And hopefully, sometimes you get lucky and you realize that things are echoing or layering on top of each other. And, you know, you're able to make strong fiction that also speaks to the world we live in.
So working in genre is kind of like having one box that can contain all of the creativity. And so staying within it is freeing because you have this small set of tools in front of you, as opposed to every tool imaginable.
Yeah, I would say structurally, in terms of what one is doing with a narrative, yes. My previous two graphic novels, Any Empire and Swallow Me Whole, are a little more nebulous and expansive. And a lot of that's because I was younger and I was figuring things out in terms of how I wanted to tell stories. So I hadn't yet, you know, crystallized a lot of my interests, or I hadn't really found the best way to apply them. But going from that sort of nebulous, expansive way of telling a story that is so free of any genre limitations that it's actually hard to find a fairly easy framework by which to explain the story to people. So after I finished Any Empire and while I was working on the March trilogy, there are several cartoonist friends of mine who have been working just embracing particular genres of storytelling for quite some time. And their work inspired me so much, some of it being just the tangible level of fun they were having as creators in writing and drawing these stories. And there's a part of me that's kind of like, I want that. So combining that with just a love for The Lathe of Heaven and The Dispossessed by Ursula Le Guin and kind of her mastery of bridging her own sci-fi and fantasy leanings with these incredible, transcendent, humanizing stories, I was like, you know, I think that this emerging story is going to be that one. So I'm just really glad to have landed at that level of comfort and preparedness to be able to execute Come Again in the way I did.
It seems like you work with social agendas as well. I mean, is having or defining a sort of social agenda within the message, is that freeing as well in sort of the same way?
It can be. I have very strong opinions. However, in the context of Come Again, you know, like there are these moments, like as I was talking about the horror of casualness in the face of an obvious crisis, you know, there are moments in which I think like my personal focus is a little more visible on the page. But I actually think that Come Again worked as well as it did because the story seemed to unfold itself while I was working it out in my sketchbook and taking notes over years and years and kind of letting it simmer on the back burner while I was doing March. In some ways, it was an escape from incredibly disciplined, responsible historical accounts that I was doing with the March trilogy. And so since I was getting that kind of, you know, satisfaction, that's kind of like political and historical satisfaction doing March, it sort of allowed me to just let the story do what it was going to do. So yeah, like the moments in which details reflect some of my social and political perspectives are nice, but I actually don't see that many of them in the pages of Come Again.
What attracted you to comics?
Well, when I was three, I started reading comics because that would have been 1981. And so Wonder Woman, Spider-Man, and the Hulk were all on TV at the same time. And that was it. Wonder Woman was my first comics love and the first series where I collected, you know, a full run of a year or so of every issue each month. It clicked with me immediately, and I started drawing when I was three as well. But it wasn't until the summer I turned 12 that my best friend, who had already been drawing comics, you know, opened his mouth and sort of invoked that, hey, we should make comics together. It really took him saying those words. I'd never considered it. And I was like, oh, of course. And frankly, I never looked back from that moment 30 years ago.
Nate Powell is the author of Come Again. He is up for a Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award in the genre category, and we'll find out if he's a winner on September the 1st. Nate, best of luck. Thanks for the work, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be on.
And finally today, a mystery series with a very unique protagonist. I spoke with Noblesville author Larry Swayze last week. Larry Swayze, welcome to All In.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
So what is See Also Proof, a Marjorie Tremaine mystery about?
See Also Proof is actually the third novel in the Marjorie Tremaine mystery series. Marjorie Tremaine is my main character, and she is a farmer's wife in 1964 North Dakota, lives on a 700-acre wheat farm with her husband, who unfortunately had a hunting accident and he's bedridden. So she has to be a caregiver as well. To pick up extra money, she took a United States Department of Agriculture correspondence course, and she learned how to be a back-of-the-book indexer, which means she's like a human Google. She writes back-of-the-book indexes for scholarly books and technical books and nonfiction books. So she knows a little bit about a lot of things. So in the first book, when there's a murder at the adjoining farm, they find an amulet, and the sheriff comes and asks Marjorie for her help because she's the smartest person he knows. So book three kind of picks up on that theme of her being kind of a farmer's wife, Sherlock Holmes. But this one is a little different. It involves a disabled girl who has Down syndrome, who goes missing in a 1964 North Dakota snowstorm. Ooh. So, yeah, brutal, brutal weather in January in North Dakota. So Marjorie offers to help the sheriff find the girl along with, you know, the rest of the town. And her and the sheriff stumble upon a car where a man has been murdered. And that kind of sets up the beginning of the book and the investigation for Marjorie to figure out, to help the sheriff figure out who murdered this well-known man in town and how it's related to the disappearance of the girl, or if it's related. And then that takes her to the Grafton State School, which is where they warehoused disabled children, people at that time. And she discovers a secret that this man had that nobody knew he had. And that puts Marjorie's life in danger. And it's the long, harrowing trip on the way back home and ultimately help the police discover who is the murderer.
Okay, you better leave it at that. That sounds intriguing. Why did you want to set this story in North Dakota? What's it like using the Midwest as a setting?
Well, one thing I wanted to do was use the Midwest. I was stationed in North Dakota in the Air Force, and so I knew the land a little bit. I was there for a couple of years. And what I really wanted was indexing. I'm an indexer. I've been an indexer as well as a writer for the last 22 years. So Marjorie and I have a lot in common. And indexing is a very isolating job. I mean, we read a lot. We're at home by ourselves a lot. So North Dakota, 700 acres in the western part of the state, is very, very isolating. But it's also, the land helps define the people. The weather helps define the people. The hard work helps define the people. And that all applies to Marjorie as well. And in that, head down, do your work, don't bring attention to yourself. Midwestern attitude was absolutely something that I wanted to explore.
Mysteries have been a popular genre for a long time. What is it about mysteries that make them endure, I guess, and stay relevant?
In mysteries, there's usually a crime. There has to be a crime of some kind. There's an investigation, and then there's a resolution. There's justice served at the end. And in real life, that doesn't happen all the time. Justice goes by unserved a lot in this world. But in a mystery novel, that's pretty much a requirement. Whether it's legally or morally or emotionally, justice has to be served in the end. And I think we're hungry for that. I think readers want that safety of knowing that there's an order to the world, that things are going to turn out okay in the end, that if somebody does something bad, they're going to be held accountable for it. And I think that's always been the allure of mystery novels.
Do you get to interact a lot with your readers? What's it like hearing from them and hearing how they react to your work?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I get, especially with the Marjorie books, I get a lot of emails from readers. And it's very gratifying when somebody will read the third book, See Also Proof, and they'll go, are there going to be more? We love Marjorie. Or I've never knew anything about indexing. I've never heard of that. I didn't know that that was a job. How can I explore that? So, and I've done that with quite a few people. I've turned them on to how to become an indexer. So it's always very, very interesting to talk to readers. It's one of the best things there is, really.
I had never heard of indexing either. I mean, I knew that there had to be somebody who did that. But I didn't know. I guess I had never imagined what it would be like to do that kind of work. Can you talk a little more about that? Because I'm kind of fascinated now by that. And I mean, working that into a story, what a great idea.
Well, I took the USDA course just like Marjorie did, or Marjorie did because I did in 1998. Now, I will have to say I'm a USDA course dropout because I didn't finish the course. Uh-huh. I got so busy with work that I really didn't have time to do that. But, indexing it's fascinating because most people think that, the author is going to do it because they know so much about the book, but the author knows too much about the book.
Ah.
They want to put everything in the book in the index, where the indexer, where I am, I'm trying to pull out the most important parts or what I think a reader is going to search for or look up. And so I'm trying to look for those, you know, those golden nuggets, whereas the author won't. So it's, you know, it's a different kind of reading. And typically in a really good year, I was doing 40 to between 40 and 60 indexes a year.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was reading a lot of, you know, one book could be like on headhunters in the Philippines, and the next book could be like on food security or an agricultural textbook or whatever. So it's a varying degree of subjects that's constantly coming across my desk. I've indexed almost 1,000 books. I've indexed 981 books so far since 1998. And so when I was taking the USDA course, I thought, wow, I was writing short stories and I was writing novels. I hadn't been published yet. But Marjorie pretty much came to me pretty quickly when I discovered the USDA course. And I thought, wow, that would, you know, an indexer as an amateur sleuth, a farmer's wife, that's just a great combination for a character. It took me a while to bring her to life and to get her voice and to figure it all out. But that's where it started. Her journey started at about the same time mine did.
Do you know how far you want to take the Marjorie Tremaine series? What's next?
That's a really good question. The publishing world's kind of strange at the moment. So, and the publisher that originally published that book sold the imprint to another publisher. So at the moment, we're kind of at a standstill with Marjorie. There was interest from Hollywood, and that kind of waned for a TV series.
Really?
But so, you just never know what's going to happen. I really would like to write more Marjorie books because it's so close to what I do and what I've done, and we've developed a following. So I don't know. We'll see. I'm hopeful that I'll write more books in that series.
What was it like hearing that you were nominated for this award, the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award?
That was a good day. it's awards are not the reason, or Hollywood or any of that is not the reason why writers write.
Sure.
But when somebody calls and says, hey, you're on a short list for this fantastic award. It's a thrill to have that kind of recognition, to have somebody notice that your work's there. And especially when it's Indiana, especially when it's your hometown, and they realize that you're here and that you've been working hard and they like your work. You know, I don't want to go Sally Field on you, you know, but you really like me, but that's kind of how it feels. It really does. And just everybody on that short list is a winner, because there's a lot of, you know, that's a deep pool of talent. And I think everybody in Indiana is a winner because of all the literary talent that's here. And so I'm grateful, just very grateful. And it was a good day.
Larry Swayze wrote See Also Proof, a Marjorie Tremaine mystery, which is up for Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award in the genre category. And we'll find out who wins on September 1st. Larry, great talking to you, and thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Matt. This has been great.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow, our conversation on college sports amid the pandemic. We'll talk to two Big Ten athletic directors about their plans. In the meantime, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.